Welcome to the Spring of Sustainability, a production of the Shift Network and the Sustainable World Coalition, and hosted this week by the Endangered Species Coalition as part of our celebration of Endangered Species Day, which is today. My name is Lita Huta, and I'm the Executive Director of the Endangered Species Coalition, and I'm so glad that you're joining to hear our two amazing panelists. Karan Suckling is the Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, and Gilly Lyons is the Policy Director of Save Our Wild Salmon. And this is a week that's been part of our Saving Vanishing Species Week. We've had an unbelievable week of panels, and we've covered a ton of different important issues related to endangered species around wildlands and pollinators, climate change, and oceans. And today we're really taking a step back to see how far we've come as a nation, and we'll be discussing why we have hope. From my perspective at the Endangered Species Coalition, I feel like there are so many reasons for us to have hope. People often ask me, how do you do that work every day, thinking about extinction and the biological diversity crisis? And actually, I feel like there's many reasons for hope. On Monday, we heard good news about a wolf named Durney, or OR7, according to scientists. He's been the first documented wolf to reach California since the early 1920s. And he has traveled back and forth between Oregon and California looking, well, basically for love, essentially. And we've just found out that he has found a mate. She's a beautiful female wolf. And we're very excited for that. And we know that Americans are excited about that news because we've seen how much our citizens care about the wolf. Recently, we had an opportunity to submit comments about the gray wolf to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is considering removing protection for wolves such as Durney. And Fish and Wildlife Service received the greatest number of comments on endangered species ever. They got 1.5 million comments, and the vast, vast, vast majority of those were in favor of protecting the wolf. And we see that even despite the efforts of our wildlife opponents, our conservation laws are still going strong. I saw an article recently, wasn't really a surprise, but it stated that the NRA and Safari Club International, two organizations that have really been working in recent years to weaken wildlife laws, are backed financially by oil and gas industries. And when you look at that, you have to marvel at how effective the wildlife conservation movement has been in protecting plants and animals. We've been successful only because Americans are so passionate about wildlife. Our really very wonderful Endangered Species Coalition President, Brock Evans, often says the reason we've won comes down to one simple word, love. And he says that all the money in the world hasn't defeated our love for nature. Because of that love, we've been able to keep laws such as the Endangered Species Act really strong. And that act in particular is a remarkable achievement. Working with our member groups in the Endangered Species Coalition, we recently published a top 10 report called Back from the Brink. And it's about 10 species that have seen remarkable recoveries. The Center for Biological Diversity has a much more exhaustive report about recovering species, and I'm sure Karan will talk about that today. Why we have hope is a very appropriate subject, as we've got hundreds of organizations and agencies all around the country celebrating Endangered Species Day today and throughout the weekend. For those of you listening in, you can learn more about those events that are happening today and throughout the weekend at endangeredspeciesday.org. And now to further inspire us about hope, I'm very excited to tell you a little bit more about Karan. Karan Suckling is a founder and the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity. He's led the center from its beginnings in 1989 as a local New Mexico environmental group to its current position as a national legal powerhouse, battling to protect endangered species, wild places, and a safe, stable climate. With undergraduate and graduate degrees in philosophy, Mr. Suckling has published numerous essays on the link between the loss of biological and cultural diversity and the essential relationship between environmentalism, the arts, the rights of marginalized communities, conservation of species, and the Endangered Species Act. He has infused the traditionally staid legal arena with a remarkable creative energy, leading the New Yorker to dub the Center for Biological Diversity the most important radical environmental group in the country. and called Karan a trickster, philosopher, publicity hound, master strategist, and unapologetic pain in the ass. The LA Weekly calls the center pound for pound, dollar for dollar, the most effective conservation organization in the country. And you can learn more about Karan's work at the Center for Biological Diversity at their website, www.biologicaldiversity.org. So Karan, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on. This is a wonderful program.
So can you tell us a little bit about the successes that we're seeing in recovering wildlife, the work that the Center for Biological Diversity is doing?
Yeah, and I'll certainly tell you about how successful, you know, that the country has been at saving endangered species since we really began this effort 40 years ago. So, you know, it's not so much about what the center has done, but just this incredible, I think, national commitment that has involved many federal agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service, state agencies, all kinds of independent university professors who've dedicated their lives to doing this research, and then just average citizens, whether they're landowners who decide to restore habitat on their land and protect species, or other citizens who decide to become watchdogs in general for these species to make sure they're protected, and and even down to school children. I got into the endangered species work, in fact, while in high school, as part of an endangered species protection program. There's a endangered turtle in Massachusetts called the Plymouth Red-Bellied Turtle, and was very close to going extinct. And one of the strategies to save it was to collect very young turtles, which were being killed in ponds, and bringing them into high schools and having high school kids raise these turtles until they were large enough to no longer be threatened, and then put them back into these ponds. And I was lucky enough to be in one of the high schools that did this work, and so just, one example, actually, of teenagers, doing work to actually very successfully save endangered species. And the net effect has been really tremendous. We've got about 1,600 species listed as endangered in this country. And many of those go back to the late 60s, although we're still adding species to the endangered species list every single year. And what's truly remarkable is, despite the massive population growth since the late 60s and all the habitat pressures and climate change and water use and just, everything you can imagine, it sort of was lined up against species. That the great majority of those 1,600 species have improved substantially since being protected because of these very intensive efforts. So a few examples. The green sea turtle was down to less than 500 nesting pairs in Florida when it went on to endangered species list. And in 2013, that number had increased to 13,000. It's really a spectacular increase. And it's all the more spectacular when you see that sea turtle species overall are declining around the world, but their U.S. populations are generally increasing. And so you can see the real difference of when a country makes that commitment and starts to do the real hard on the ground work of saving species, that they start improving even as they're declining elsewhere. Another species from the East Coast is the piping plover, another beach nester, which was also down to less than 500 pairs when it was put on the endangered species list and is now close to 2,000 pairs in the New England area. Or manatees down in Florida. There were fewer than 1,000 of those when they were put on the endangered species list, and there's now over 5,000 of them And, you know, a lot of this work even takes place in really industrialized, urbanized areas. You know, one species you can really see that with is the endangered Hudson River sturgeon, right? So it occurs in the Hudson River from New York City right there, you know, all the way up to Albany. And its numbers have increased from about 13,000 fish to over 60,000 today due to restoration efforts and protection. So we really do have reason to hope because we're making very real progress for most endangered species. And we've got a long way to go, and we're certainly not in a place where we can say, oh, success and, you know, hands off. And certainly the ones, especially in these urbanized areas, are going to need a permanent commitment of us to making sure they've got a place to live. But we really have saved them. We really have done that. They would be extinct by now without all this work. And it really gives me reason for hope and certainly gives the species reasons for hope.
Thanks, Garon. And now it's my pleasure to also introduce Gilly Lyons. Gilly is the policy director of Save Our Wild Salmon. Gilly began her tenure with Save Our Wild Salmon as the Washington, D.C. representative in October 2003. And after 5 years in our nation's capital, she returned to Portland, Oregon, and served as Save Our Wild Salmon's senior policy analyst. Prior to joining the staff at Save Our Wild Salmon, Gilly spent 6 years as grassroots coordinator for the Oregon Natural Desert Association in Bend and Portland, Oregon, and 2 years as legislative advocate for the National Public Lands Grazing Campaign in Washington, D.C. And despite all those years working on terrestrial issues, she's been enchanted by the Columbia Basin and the salmon there since working on the Oregon Clean Stream Initiative in 1996. Gilly, who hails from New York City, holds a Master's of Science in Environmental Studies from the University of Montana. She's not much of an angler, but she keeps intending to take lessons. And Gilly lives in Portland now with her beau, Alan, and her trusty co-pilot, Gracie. You can see more about Gilly's work at www.wildsalmon.org. Gilly, thank you so much for joining us on this panel.
Oh, thank you, Lita, and thanks for that kind introduction. I and also, Caron, thank you for your great remarks. It's a wonderful reminder that that despite all of the sometimes very daunting news that we hear about species and their struggles, that there really is a lot of progress to celebrate. And I wanted to talk a little bit today about my organization's work specifically on salmon and steelhead populations in the Pacific Northwest, and specifically in an area called the Columbia Basin, which is actually an enormous chunk of territory. It's an area about the size of France, right around 75 million acres, that encompasses much of the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, along with parts of Montana, Nevada, and also the Canadian province of British Columbia. And the Columbia Basin was once home to the most abundant populations of salmon in the lower 48 states, anywhere outside of Alaska. And estimates say that anywhere between 16 and 30 million salmon would return to the Columbia and its largest tributary, the Snake River, each year. And the Snake River Basin, which is the a big chunk of the Columbia Basin, sort of inside the Columbia Basin, used to produce about half of those fish. So just a very productive watershed, sort of a salmon powerhouse. And unfortunately, now, today, due to a whole range of impacts such as habitat loss, logging, development, historic overfishing, and most of all, a lengthy and very destructive era of dam building throughout the basin, we now see less than 2% of those historic populations coming back to the basin. And now we have about 13 runs of salmon and steelhead that are listed as threatened or endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And that that accounts for just under half of all West Coast salmon listings. All Pacific salmon listings account for about 27 species, and 13 of them reside in the Pacific Northwest. So it's sort of an unfortunate distinction, but just to give you a sense of how many how many populations used to thrive here and how many we've lost and what we're, you know, what we're now struggling to really hold on to. And one of the most remarkable of those 13 species in the Columbia Basin is the Snake River sockeye, which is a tremendous fish that has a really remarkable migration. It swims to and from the Pacific Ocean, covering about 900 miles between the Sawtooth Mountains of central Idaho all the way to the Pacific and back, and climbs about 7,000 feet in elevation in each direction, just a really heroic, Herculean, Olympic-style migration. And they are also the most endangered salmon species in North America and probably the world. And just to give you a sense of how close to bottoming out Snake River sockeye have come, in 1991, one individual salmon returned to spawn in an area called Redfish Lake in central Idaho in the Sawtooth Mountains. And so just one individual, they named him Lonesome Larry because he had no other compatriots. And so things were obviously very, very dire for this species about 24 years ago. And since that time, there has been an enormous effort on the part of a number of partners, federal agencies, state agencies, Native American tribes, watershed councils, all sorts of cross-state joint efforts to bring these species back, this species in particular, back from the brink. And now we do have, although they're still in pretty enormously large trouble, we do get to see several hundred Snake River sockeye returning each year. So thanks to this very sort of full court press, this huge effort on the part of so many different partners, there has been a significant turnaround in the fate of this particular salmon, which is wonderful news. And another area of sort of a bright spot on the map in terms of seeing a previously very, very imperiled fish come back from those dire numbers of the early to mid-90s is Snake River fall chinook, which is another very, very important species that returns to Idaho via the Columbia and the Snake Rivers. And thanks to a variety of efforts on the part of conservation groups and tribes and some states, there has been a program in place that's helped send more water over the tops of dams to help younger fish out to the river, out down the river and back out to the ocean and back. And thanks to in part that restoration measure, we are preparing for what may be a near record return of Snake River fall chinook this fall, where as many as 1.6 million fish might come back. Now, I hasten to add that about anywhere from 75 to 80% of those fish are hatchery origin fish, which makes them not exactly entirely wild, but it is a step in the right direction, and it's just really encouraging to see that if you give salmon a little bit of a chance, really just half a chance, if you make their habitat a little less unfriendly, if you make it a river run a little bit more like a river, then they will respond. And so it's just a wonderful story of hope, I think, for what may be possible in the future.
Thank you so much, Gilly. You know, Karan, you had talked about the recovery of these species, and Gilly talked about how we've come from Lonesome Larry to beginning to see some recovery of the Snake River sockeye. And do you think that the recoveries are happening fast enough? Are the populations growing fast enough? And is there sort of a standard way for judging that?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is actually a really important question, both in terms of trying to understand whether we're being successful or not now, but also, you know, where is all this headed in the future? So, you know, on the first side of that, for example, you'll often hear critics in the Endangered Species Act say, well, only 2% of the 1,600 species on the list have recovered and gone off the list. And so, my God, 2%, that's a terrible success rate, and that means we're 98% failure rate. And that's, I think, probably the central message you'll hear from critics of endangered species conservation.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds impressive at first, and those numbers, in fact, are correct, but they're also meaningless because these species take a lot longer than that to recover, and it's way too early to say, oh, not, they haven't recovered yet, so it's a failure. And in fact, almost every species on the endangered species list, including all the ones we've talked about today, including the salmon, they have a federal recovery plan. And these are very large, exhaustive plans, which not only tell us how to recover the species, but tell us how long this is expected to take. And if you look at those official estimates of the time it's going to take, and you compare that to how long we've been trying to do it, one of the first things you'll notice is that, on average, species on the endangered species list have been there for about 22 years. That's how long we've been working to protect them. And on average, the length of time stipulated to recover them is about 45 years by the recovery plan. And so it's kind of ridiculous to say, oh, let's set a standard where we need the species to recover twice as fast as their recovery plans say, or we'll declare it to be a failure. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So it's actually entirely expected that few species will have recovered by now, because we haven't done the recovery work yet that needs to be done. So if you really want to know how the Act is working, what you've got to do is look at the expected time to recovery, look at the actual time to recovery, and say, are we getting there on schedule or not? And the answer is we are, and we're remarkably close. And so we've done a study looking at several hundred endangered species to answer this question, and what we found that about 90% of species are recovering at the rate expected by their recovery plans. And so I would suggest that not only any conservation effort, but any law, any social effort that we can imagine that has a 90% success rate is pretty darn good. So it's really important to sort of get really clear standards of what to expect, so we can know if we're getting there on time, and generally we are getting there on time. So that's really good news. I'm not sure it's going to change the minds of these critics, because at the end of the day, you know, they're complaining about species recovery because it cuts into corporate profits, not because of recovery rates. But nonetheless, I think the public, once they understand that this is long work, it took hundreds of years to endanger these species, and so to think it's going to take 50 or 60 to recover them is not at all exceptional. It's just the long work we need to solve these problems.
Right, that makes perfect sense, Karan. I will let our listeners know that later in the session, if there's time, we'll be taking questions from the audience. So you can begin to think of some questions you'd like to ask, and if you have one and you've dialed in to the panel, you can press 1 on your phone keypad, or if you're listening to the webcast, you can enter your question into the chat window on your screen. Really, as Karan is talking about all of these kinds of all this recovery that's happening in endangered species, I can't help but think about sort of the web of life and what that means for other species. You know, we're really focused on these endangered species themselves, but the impact they have on lots of other species is kind of remarkable in many ways. And I think that many people who follow this issue have heard about the kind of impacts that wolves have had as they returned back to Yellowstone, and how that's benefited the rivers, the plants and beavers and songbirds, and this incredible return of the ecosystem to a healthier, more balanced state. But I think that people probably don't know about things like salmon and the impact that salmon has. And I feel like it's a really fascinating story, you know, sort of their connection to orcas, but also what it means when they return to their spawning grounds and the impact that it has for ecosystems, even inland. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. It's interesting to think of salmon a little bit as a keystone species, the way I think we think of wolves, in that just the in terms of the role that they play in kind of in terms of the glue of an ecosystem and really kind of keeping things together. And in the case of Columbia Basin salmon, and I'll also just say that there are some incredible photographs out there of wolves, I think mostly in Alaska, eating salmon right out of a river, which are just remarkable. So just in terms of bringing some of these images together, it's just an amazing thing to see, not just bears and eagles, but you can sometimes see wolves eating salmon too. But in terms of the role that salmon do play in the Pacific Northwest as sort of an ecological keystone or kind of linchpin, anywhere from 150 to 180 different species either directly or indirectly rely on Columbia Basin salmon for as a food source or as a nutrient source sort of later in the life cycle. And that goes for orcas out in the Pacific Ocean that swim up and down the Pacific Northwest coast between California and Washington State. They have shown the southern resident killer whales that are currently listed under the Endangered Species Act have shown a great predilection for and preference for specifically Columbia Basin Chinook. They absolutely love Columbia Basin Chinook. They also love Puget Sound fish because that's where they spend a lot of their time, but a number of studies have shown that they really enjoy the big sort of omega-3 rich fatty fish that swim to and from the Columbia River. So there is that incredible connection to orcas, and as go the salmon, certainly as so go the orcas, absolutely. And then also in terms of what salmon bring from the ocean into the interior Northwest when they make their migration back upstream to spawn, it's just remarkable. They actually are part of a huge nutrient transfer system that has been greatly disrupted by our bisecting of rivers and just basically, you know, cutting off access to and from the Pacific with an enormous system of dams in the Pacific Northwest. But still, and prior to that system of dams going in and now a little bit in a much more reduced way, we have salmon bringing marine nutrients from the Pacific Ocean into the interior portions of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon, and depositing those incredibly valuable nutrients in the soil as they spawn, and then as the bodies of the salmon decay on the stream banks, and they may enter the soil there as they break down, or they may be consumed by another animal and then deposited elsewhere through other natural methods that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you'll sometimes see in studies of the composition of old growth trees as far inland as central Idaho, which is, you know, the better part of 1,000 miles from the Pacific Ocean, you will sometimes be able to find marine nutrients in the bark and the interior, basically flesh of these trees, and it's just an incredible thing, and it shows you how vital those nutrients have been over the course of millennia in terms of being able to help all sorts of tremendous growth in areas that are generally a little more sterile in terms of their nutrients, higher alpine, higher elevation, glacially fed places that don't have the kinds of nutrients as lower elevation places. And that's what salmon do. They bring those good vitamins inland and help entire ecosystems thrive. So we certainly need more of that.
Yeah, that is so interesting and amazing and so neat.
Hey, Lita,
can I
follow up on that? Because, you know, what's fascinating is, you know, that in addition to this ecology that Gilly is telling us about and how the salmon, you know, are related to so many other species, there's similarly, you know, a real sort of political ecology showing how, as humans protect these species, they're also protecting so many others, you know, at the same time. And, you know, I've been doing some research looking at, endangered species along the Atlantic coast. And one of the things that really struck out to me, which I guess I should have known in advance, but it was really kind of an eye-opener as I was figuring this out piece by piece, is that as I was looking at species which are more recently the target of conservation efforts on the Atlantic coast, in most cases, they were living in habitat areas protected for species that were earlier the subjects of conservation efforts. And so particularly what I saw there was the piping plover. You know, we've protected beach areas from Maine all the way down the Atlantic coast and across to Florida for piping plovers. And those very same areas are where all kinds of endangered plants are living, other endangered birds like roseate terns, endangered beetles as well, and a whole host of species. And they're also the places where the people like to go. So, in fact, you know, if you're on the Atlantic coast and you go to a beach, and you know how crowded they can be, if you go to a beach and you're like, oh, well, this mm-hmm. beach isn't crowded. It's quiet. It's nice. You know, there's a 90% chance that the reason it's quiet and nice and crowded is it's being protected for an endangered species. And so we're really, I think, you know, by protecting these individual species successfully, protecting hundreds of other species that end up living in that spot, because that's the only protected spot around, and we're also creating exactly the places where people want to go and recreate. They want to go to those wild salmon areas that Gilly was talking about. They want to go to beaches that aren't overrun with ORVs, and that tends to be the places that we decided, hey, let's not trash this place because there's endangered species here.
Right. I think, you know, in protecting species, we're really seeing the interconnectedness between them, but also impact that it has on us and the quality of life, essentially, is improving as we protect wildlife. I see that we are starting to get some questions rolling in, so I'm going to start taking questions from the audience. And again, just to remind folks, if you have a question, you've dialed in by phone, press 1 on your keypad, and if you're on the webcast, enter your question into the chat window. And Tarvo, if you could connect us, we see there's a question from a caller in, so it's area code 612. So if you're calling in from 612, welcome, and what's your question? We're having a little bit of a hard time hearing you.
Hey, Alita, it seems that maybe they pressed 1 by accident.
Okay. Thanks, Arvo. So why don't we take a webcast question that we have that's come in. We've got a lot. Sorry. So it says, the Endangered Species Act and lots of other conservation laws passed 40 years ago. Do you see that same fervor of support for the environment today? And do you believe future generations will also believe in protecting species and that the environment is important?
Wow, well, that's a great question. I do, and that's also one of the reasons why I have hope, obviously, right? Because no matter how well we've done to date, all that can be undone by future generations, right, if they stop caring. But I think they will, and I think especially for endangered species. And, you know, one of the things I always keep in mind in that regard is just how central species protection and species love, as you talked about earlier, Alita, is to our culture. And if you keep in mind, for example, that the story of Noah's Ark, right, is a story of love of species. It's a story of conservation. It's a story of how important it is for us to save them. But, you know, the oldest version of that story that we have is the Sumerian story, 1,600 years before the Old Testament was written. And so the Western commitment and love of other species. It's biophilia. Is almost 2,000 years older than Christianity. So that's a very, very deep core value, which is not going to change in the next 100 years or 200 years.
Thank you. Gilly, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I would just would definitely echo what Karan just said and note that sometimes it is a little tricky to compare 40 years ago to today in terms of political, or I should say congressional support for some of these kinds of initiatives that obviously passed with overwhelming support, bipartisan support, in the late 60s and early 70s in Congress, and how things are a little slash very different today. And sometimes that can, I think some of us can get sort of caught in feelings of frustration, trending towards despair when it comes to the reality of Congress today and thinking about trying to protect species that way. But I think to balance that out, obviously, that's just one part of that's just one lens through which we can see current realities. And I do think that the overwhelming support for the Endangered Species Act and for protecting endangered species that we see in public poll after public poll, just in terms of the American people's sentiment about making sure that we protect the web of life and biodiversity and the things that make this country so remarkably just unique and special and gorgeous and invaluable, I think those are the metrics that I think are the most encouraging and the most realistic to look at. And I think that goes exactly to the question of love of nature that I think is a really defining aspect of the American experience, and I think that will persevere going forward in perpetuity, which is a wonderful thing, regardless of current political realities, which I think are much more of a fleeting snapshot rather than any kind of indicator.
Thank you, Kelly. I couldn't agree more. I think that makes perfect sense. And we definitely, the coalition, has seen the next generation really engaged in a deep and meaningful way on endangered species and how much they care. You know, we do an art contest, and these kids do these amazing works of art, and they do lots of research about the species. We've got lots of different kids who are participating on protecting the wolf and have been doing videos and have been running their own campaigns. Sort of grassroots, they started themselves. It's been very heartening for us. So we have another caller on the phone. I think this may be the last call we'll be able to take. So, Carvo, if you could connect us. And if you're calling in, you're on the line now.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I wanted to address a little bit about more creative approaches to saving species that particularly inspire the speakers. I know I just saw recently something on the news that absolutely blew me away, where there was a fish whose migration pattern was broken because of development, and they had trucks where they actually filled the trucks with water to provide water for these fish, put the fish on the truck, took the trucks across to the place where the river began again, and put them back in. And it was such a massive effort, and it just brought such warmth to my heart to see something like this happening. And Karen, you mentioned about your high school students, you know. And so I wondered if you know of any other creative approaches that just really touch you.
Well, yeah, I could address a few of those that are that I've seen that really touched me. There's an endangered fish in California called the Mojave Tule Chub. And its natural habitat has almost been completely destroyed by water pumping and urban development. And some high school kids who live in high school near what used to be a river where the species lived went to a conference about the species held by some scientists and decided they wanted to do their part to save it. And they went back and they actually convinced their school to go out with bulldozers and cement pouring in the whole thing and like build these ponds in the former river where this fish could live. And they did this. They built an entire wetland habitat from scratch, and now that's one of the places where this endangered species lives to this day. It's one of the six populations of it. And that was a few years ago. Those high school kids have moved on. So now the new high school kids are busy making sure that habitat stays in good condition. And interestingly, one of the ways that has to be done there is it needs to burn. To burn off the scrub that builds up around it. And, of course, kids love nothing more than setting fires, right? So you've got these kids out there setting fires, doing habitat restoration, and it's amazing. You know, it's really quite incredible. Another sort of inspiring but scary story, you know, so the bald eagle, you know, we think of the bald eagle, which, of course, meant just amazing success story. This is a species that was down to about 30 pairs in the U.S. in the late 60s, and now it's got well over 13,000 pairs. A huge success. You know, we tend to mostly think about that in terms of the banning of DDT, which was thinning their eggshells, and that certainly was, you know, an enormous and critical thing to have done, and we wouldn't have saved the species without that. However, what people know less about, because it's sort of a quieter work that you don't hear, is that bald eagles were directly reintroduced to most of the states in the East. And if they were not directly reintroduced, they wouldn't be there. And in one case, the reintroductory effort being done in Washington, D.C., done by these inner-city school kids. And they successfully reintroduced this species, brought birds in from out of state, brought eggs in, and got them reintroduced. And this, to give you a sense of the kind of conditions these kids were working in, two of the kids working in the reintroduction program, during the reintroduction program, were killed in gang violence, gang warfare in Washington, D.C. And so we're not talking about sort of, you know, rich kids with lots of leisure time living out in the suburbs, working to protect endangered species to, you know, put on their resume to get into college. You know, we're talking about inner city kids living in tough, poor conditions, who also see that they need to improve their environments and are working on that, as well. And so that gives me a lot of hope as well, because you really see that love of species just goes across every economic spectrum, race, religion, in this country.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karan. I wanted to ask each of you a final question, and given what you've talked about, what you would see as sort of the most high-level specific kinds of actions that you would encourage listeners to take to help protect vanishing species. You know, many of our listeners today are people who really want to participate in transformation of our society and of our planet. And so it would be great to hear from each of you, you know, ideas that you may have. And Gilly, if you could go first, and I definitely would want you to also, I'm telling you what to tell us, but including your answer at least in part, letting people know about damnation.
Oh, absolutely, yes, and I'm so glad, because I was definitely going to mention that when you mentioned the sort of what can folks do, and there are a couple of things that I think are would be wonderful for people to consider in terms of, you know, taking action or next steps when it comes specifically to Columbia Basin salmon and or really endangered salmon anywhere, and one of them is if you have an opportunity, is to see a terrific film that Lita just mentioned. It's called Damnation, and it's a documentary that was recently released, and it's produced by the clothing company Patagonia. So it's kind of an unusual alliance between a corporation that has a lot of very closely held values and ethics around protecting the environment, and they provided the resources for unaffiliated filmmakers to go out and make this just gorgeous and inspiring film about the growing nationwide movement around community-led efforts to remove harmful or outdated dams on rivers across the country, and it's a movement that has I guess it's sort of unofficial headquarters in the Pacific Northwest, in that the largest dam removal projects taken on so far have been on Northwest rivers, on the Elwha River in Olympic National Park. Two dams are coming out there, that a project that's been decades in the making. And then another dam was decommissioned, actually blown up about 3 years ago, on the White Salmon River, which is a tributary to the Columbia River in Washington State. And the response of salmon to those dam removals, as they have been elsewhere in the country, it has been remarkable and almost instantaneous. There is just an unbelievable ability on the part of salmon that have been cut off from historic habitat for 100 years or more to be able to figure out where they need to go when those obstacles are removed. And it's just a really lovely film. There's a website, damnationfilm.com, that lists screenings around the country. There's one happening in communities just everywhere, every night of the week, practically. It's being shown in many, many places, large and small, and it's just a really great look at both the role of dams in America, but also the important things that happen when people get together in order to restore habitat and bring salmon back to a community. And it's a nice reminder that we can all play a role in that by joining a local watershed council or getting involved with, you know, a stream restoration group in your neighborhood or anything. It doesn't have to be a ginormous federally funded project by any stretch of the imagination. There's lots of ways to be able to chime in on something like this. So anyway,
thanks, Gary.
Yeah, see that.
Ron, we're wrapping up a little bit here, but we've got another minute or so. If you could also give us
sure.
an action that you'd encourage.
Yeah, well, you know, this is not so much an action as, you know, an observation and a notion of a commitment. You know, we've been going through, you know, each of the 1,600 species on the endangered species list, one by one, and seeing which are improving and which aren't, and trying to figure out, you know, what actions are working best. And one of the things that has really struck out to me is that species definitely do better, recover faster, less likely to go extinct, when some individual becomes that species hero that steps up and decides, I'm really going to watch over this species. I'm going to devote my time and energy to making sure it recovers. And sometimes that's a conservation group. Sometimes it's a state biologist. Sometimes it's someone leading a federal recovery program. And sometimes it's just an individual citizen who decides that this is what I'm going to do with my life, is I'm going to become the advocate of this species. And when a species has an advocate like that, it is vastly more likely to recover than when the species is sort of just being, you know, worked through the general bureaucracy of recovery. And there's a big bureaucracy of recovery that exists, and it does okay. It does fairly well. But when it just becomes a matter of committee, it's very, very different from having the passion of an individual person with a name who says, I'm going to make sure this species recovers. That's when we see the real action. So one of the great upsides of massive human overpopulation is that there's more of us to adopt these species and take them on and become species heroes. And that's what we really, really need to see for recovery.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Karan. Those are great suggestions. For more, our listeners can go to springofsustainability.com/actions, and you can take some of the actions listed there, check them off so that we could track them, and then we'll be able to see a cumulative impact of the Spring of Sustainability. And you can access all the wonderful recordings and transcripts that have been part of this Spring of Sustainability by going to springofsustainability.com/upgrade. It's been a great session today with Karan and Gilly, and a phenomenal week. It's not over yet. This evening you can gather your entire family as actor, director, and environmentalist Ed Begley Jr. joins us for a conversation and reads us the classic Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. So be sure to listen in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time and 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. And you can stay connected to all of these things on Facebook at Spring of Sustainability. And, of course, you can check back to biologicaldiversity.org and wildsalmon.org for more about Karan and Gili. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening today, for supporting endangered species through your participation in this program, and for taking action to help protect endangered species, and most importantly, to continue to have hope. Thank you, everyone.